Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
As penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million books, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I allow to taste the truths of the Tathagata's words.
I'm ready. You ready? I want to start with something, which is to just express my gratitude for everybody. This being our last talk with just the Sesshin group. I wanted to thank all of you that took time to have Doka-san with me. That was precious to share your practice. And while it's questionable if it was helpful to you, it was profoundly helpful to me. So thank you for that generosity that you offered. Thank you for the food, the tenzo and the fukuten and all the kitchen help. Are you familiar with Baijong?
No.
He was this monk and he said, a day without work is a day without food. So it's hard work living in a practice community. And Michael, thank you for your vigilance, dedication, and organization. Amanda, for being glue. You are a boulder at Jokoji. But in particular, the mountain I'm sitting next to. Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you for the invitation, for your teaching, for your time, your kindness. I felt inspired by something I heard secondhand about Doug or from Doug that I wanted to start with. Senshu was very generous in sharing a little bit of her Doka-san with me. And I told you she asks hard questions. And she asked Doug, what's your main teaching? Which is a great question, an incredible question to ask a teacher. And Doug responded, just to show up. In a sense, for those of us on the path, still trying to see what this is, it's the greatest expression of wisdom. It is not a conceptual gesture. It's just showing up. And a lot of times when we approach practice, it's how do I do this? How do I work with this? How can I better? And they're important questions, but sometimes we don't give ourselves enough credit for just showing up. Showing up in the midst of our confusion and in the midst of our clarity. At the monastery, sometimes somebody's going through some sort of tumultuous situation and they just say, oh, I probably should just stay away. I'm trouble for others. And when we show up, it's an offering. It's a gesture of generosity because you give people an opportunity to receive you. And that's an incredible gesture. The Buddha offered generosity by asking for help through alms, indiscriminately going from house to house and giving each house an opportunity to make an offering. So it wasn't some grand thing the Buddha gave, but creating an opportunity to receive. And so I'm just grateful for that, that when we aren't sure what to do, that we can show up in our confusion and in our clarity. Your presence does not necessitate any profound wisdom, concepts. It is the sincerity. And if there is one thing Doug does in the little time I've known him, it's he shows up. He's a teacher who is present. Still not sure about realization as an experience. I think I'll have more questions next time. But that was and is a teaching that continues to blow me away, that sometimes it is enough to show up. And I think Doug's going to talk a little bit about that and the bridge we were trying to create, right? The bridge between our practice is to show up, and this is what the Lankavatara is encouraging us to do. So would you share with us what we were talking about suchness?
Okay. A part of suchness is thanking you for showing up here. You San and you Yun and Senshu for making the effort to come here and share the monastic practice that you're doing there, because it's changed us here in subtle ways, and your teachings have been wonderful, and I've never had so many Dokusans, and I want to repeat thanking everybody for meeting me and Dokusan so I could meet you and Dokusan, because I've never had that experience of it's really amazing, isn't it?
It's powerful.
So we'll have more thank yous tomorrow, but no. You know, one of the important things for me is gratitude. It seems like that's one of the humbling qualities that helps me. And I'm not quite sure how it dovetails into suchness, other than there's a definition of the dharmas, the small d dharmas, that Red Pine shares, and the small d dharmas, the phenomena that exists, are they make an appearance to us. We give them names. I'm calling Rick, the former governor of Texas. Couldn't get to three. The third one is
Projections
that we've been talking about. You make projections. And then the last two of small d dharmas are knowledge. It's like clear knowledge, the clear knowledge and suchness was the some knowledge and suchness kind of fit together. And there's a, I wrote something here about suchness. that was provocative to me in this translation. There were several aspects of suchness that Vedpai illuminated. Right? These two. Katagiri Roshi talked about suchness as just this it is. Red Pine defines suchness as what is not affected by anything. Is there anything that is not affected by other things? So that's a big question to me. But what is not affected by anything? And so maybe to consider that in this context, the suchness of the floor and the walls and the ceiling, the suchness of the Han and its effect on the building when it is hit. What is not affected by anything? I have to study that one more. I don't know if you've examined that one. And also, suchness is what transcends mistaken projections. And I think I talked about mistaken projections having to do with hostility. Yesterday. But there are a lot of mistaken projections that we have. So what transcends, what penetrates, what blows away these mistaken projections that we have is suchness. There were a few other attributes of suchness that he describes. What is real, true, certain, ultimate, self-existent, ungraspable. These are characteristics of suchness. So there.
I heard when you read that to me, that what is unaffected, and for me, that dovetailing is the showing up part, that in a sense, when we just show up, that space that doesn't have an agenda, that it accommodates everything that arises within it. The image of the blue sky, it's like after the clouds passed, the blue sky is not marked. It's not marked by the jets or the birds or the bombs. And in a sense, in a very relative way, when we just show up, we are that space. We are that space when we come to the cushion and we have that attitude of whatever's put in front of me, I'm going to eat it. So Kazan's been saying lately, I'm going to eat it. Whatever shows up, I'm going to receive it. It probably doesn't look or feel like space, and it probably doesn't look or feel like that which is unaffected. But it is our generosity and our gesture that if something arises, you welcome it. Something arises, it has a right to be there. And when it leaves, it has a right to leave. So I really like that. Mm-hmm. Shunryu Suzuki had a really funny zing that we often talk about at the monastery. And he said, when I see my students all I see is the Buddha until they open their mouths.
Anyone care to open their mouth?
I'm wearing a mask.
These masks have been wonderful and annoying.
Yeah.
Both. I've kind of enjoyed them during the mealtime because I can lick my lips. They hide all sorts of things.
Thusness, suchness.
And I guess being unaffected, when things are unaffected, maybe that's referring to eating what shows up just as it is, instead of rejecting or whatever. And I think that practice is quite intimate in this Sashin, of showing up to your seat, showing up to yourself, face on the wall, showing up to the wall, and showing up to the, why am I here? You know, that's part of showing up too, I think, is that questioning.
It's like everything's invited. The one talk Shoho gave it, Soka Koji, I was talking with Sokazan on our video chat the other night. We only remember one thing from it. We forgot the rest of the talk. But he said, be a good host. Be a good host. And that's the thing to me about thusness, is it's not a dissolving into nothingness. It's thusness in the midst of uniqueness and contrast and texture, and all of it is present. No discrimination.
But discernment is part of this existence too, which might be nuanced, different than differentiation. Differentiation is usually like and don't like. But discerning is like, this is the moment to be a good host. And I like the host guest duality, because when we go to receive tea in the tea hut, it's there's the host and one of the guests. However, I noticed that in a way, a guest has to also be a good host, has to assist the host in being the host. And that's where I've had a lot of refinement and continuing refinement of, for example, in going to the prison, they wanted to call me sensei, or are you known as Roshi? And I go, I'm Doug. And they want to call me something with reverence. And I have an aversion to that. So I was not being a good host, even though I'm a guest in the prison, receiving their, or being a good guest and receiving their, what they have to offer, anyway, just tenderize me a little more. Not that I let them say that, because I just assume they're Buddhists too. And But I've noticed times when being a lousy host really makes, or a lousy guest makes it really difficult for the host. And the job of, so we're always a host, I think, when we're even a guest. And maybe we get that experience in this way that we serve each other in the meals too. We're each serving each other.
It's an interesting word too, because it shows up, and I'm sure at some point you may chant Hokyo Zanmai, the song of the Jomir Samadhi. Mm-hmm. And one of the last lines is the host within the host, that it actually calls Buddha nature, that Tathagata Garbha, a host, the host within the physical host, the one that holds everything within the temporal, the host within the host. And when you were talking about discernment and discrimination, the kind of that difference, it reminds me of like contrast versus comparison. To compare things is to put values, put something above or below, whereas contrast is just noticing the texture, noticing that it's not the same, but it doesn't necessarily mean, wow, this is better, this is worse. And I like that. For me, that's helpful, to go down into the texture, because the mind is wanting a reference point that further reifies polarity. Mm-hmm. We can actually begin to feel, when we're a good host, we can actually begin to feel the texture of and quality of the mind, and the emotions and the senses.
Regarding gratitude in relation to suchness, it seems to me that if I'm very present and I can just suspect that I'm being sensitive to to suchness, it seems to me that then the gratitude arises out of the suchness, the experiencing of it, or the receiving of it, and it's inevitable, and because the feeling is very positive, and then there's a gratitude function.
Comment on the host, isn't that what they call the body of Christ? When you have communion, you have the wafer or bread, and it's called the host, and that's what you eat.
So they call it the host, and do you imagine it as, in the way that we talk about guest and host and in this practice?
I just call it the host. That's why I'm a Buddhist. I never understood a lot of this stuff. You know, like, you can get at the metaphor of like Jesus and that in a sense Jesus is everything. And so then when you're eating the bread and drinking the wine, you're in a sense taking in, you know, everything, you might say. But I don't know. You know, it gets confusing. But yeah, it's the communion is where you're communing with, you know, Jesus. It's considered actually Jesus that you're eating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is suchness relative?
I don't know, how's that? To me, when I think of it as a concept, it is as something to be talked about, but like the Lanka says, what words point at is often the truth. So I think, how are you differentiating the concept from the reality, the actuality, the realization of it?
You used that word realization just now, and maybe we'll get to what you're asking too, but it's like, the other day I said that realization is an experience. We experience realization. And you took exception to that or wondered about it. You know, I mean, we had a little conversation about it.
So. Quite respectfully, I might add.
Yeah. Now you're making a differentiation here. So I told you that I had just made that up. That realization is an experience, but if you have a realization, it is an experience. And so and I want to tie it to what Jero just talked about too, about when we're meeting suchness, that it's natural for gratitude to follow. In a way, that is an aspect of the realization of suchness is gratitude, and all of that is experienced, you know, in this, in us. So I can't see how it would be separate from experience. And if realization were separate from experience, then it would be, it'd be something we'd go after, or separate, if it's a separate thing. If realization is a separate thing, then how do we go get realization? Oh, there's a, I found a tree up on the hill where it's hiding. Let's go dig it up and bring all that realization back here. But to me, it's like, and feeling the texture is in that sensing the texture, there is a realization of what that texture is. So it's like it requires experience to make it happen. And we, try to be empty enough of our baggage that we usually carry to just directly experience it.
I think an experience, you experience a realization. The realization itself is not an experience. The realization to me would be many things coming together. It's an aha moment that's been circulating in your subconscious, maybe for decades, who knows. Everything comes together and suddenly you can see something that you couldn't see before that was right in front of you. But then you take it in. But how you experience is just a description of the realization. The realization wouldn't be the experience. It would be your reaction to it. The realization would be crystal. It's almost as if you, when you add salt to a supersaturated solution, and it suddenly crystallized like that. Just one more molecule, and you get an instant crystal. Everything crystallizes at that moment. That's a realization to me. And then you looking at that would be the experience, or how it affects you would be the experience. Oh, thank you.
What I appreciated about our conversation last night as well was the myriad ways in which the Dharma needs to present itself based on the people that are in front of it. That really stood out to me. So when I think about the semantics of realization, I don't know how one would accurately articulate that, but also recognizing how it may need to be communicated in so many ways to resonate with that individual so that they can see it for themselves. And so I think I'm still looking and asking questions, because sometimes we get so absorbed with our one vocabulary around the Dharma that this is the right way to talk about the Dharma. We don't recognize how subjective it is and how it needs to have a subjective quality, because it has to resonate here. And we talked about that with forms too. It's like what we do at Soka Koji is a sharp contrast, but to add on other people should be doing that would not respect the individuals that come into a situation. And so that's what's incredible about the Dharma. It's so incredible to see that what's happening at Jikoji is perfect. It's perfect. But we couldn't do it at Soka Koji. And what's happening at Soka Koji is perfect. Probably wouldn't work at Jikoji, but a little bit. We're learning, we're taking things back. We're leaving a few things. Maybe to use on, I don't know. But when I was talking to Senshu last night, that was like what I brought up is I don't know. So any sort of argument you can make is just because my thoughts are strong, my thoughts are right. Instead of thinking, how would it look if it was that way? Or what is that? And so you just show up. You just show up to the Dharma. And in that way, the Dharma is much more pleasant. It's much more enjoyable because you're not fighting somebody's wrong Dharma with your right Dharma. You actually just want to see, to understand, to receive.
Yeah, to understand is a form of realization. So have there been some deeper understandings during this week together, Curtis?
Thinking about projections last night when I went to bed, a future scenario came up in my mind, and I immediately came to some projected outcome of the scenario. And I happened to notice or point at it as a projection. And as soon as I did that, it was kind of like when you buy a TV at a store and it's brand new, and there's a plastic film on the front, and you peel off the plastic film. When I noticed the projection, I was able to sort of like peel it away. And behind the projection was just the imaginative scenario. And as soon as I noticed the projection, it sort of made a reaction in my body. Body picked up, because I was imagining the worst case scenario pretty much. And as it peeled away, my body started to relax. And it sort of made me think that the projection was only indirectly affecting my body. So maybe it was produced by my mind somehow. And then my mind, tingled some sensations in my body.
Well, first off, I appreciate what you said about the different ways of speaking to people. I think we have a Sunday program and there's all these newcomers, and if you talk to them, they're like from so many different backgrounds, and oftentimes they've been on a path. And so, yeah, I think what Jokoji is works for that. But You know, I apologize for interrupting you this morning in your silence, but I think saying to you that, you know, that it's not about the words. The reason I practice is because life's a wonder, and I want to sort of feel that, you know, not just have it. I mean, it's so obvious that life is amazing, but I don't necessarily get it in my bones. And so saying that, and it's not the words, you know, it's like that's what I had been feeling as I was walking down the hill. But then after I said that to you, you know, I was meditating and, you know, trying to settle down. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, that's the whole point, you know, that we cherish the three jewels, because they're like the support we have in order for me to reach what I want. So it was helpful to speak it and then say, oh, well, maybe it's not about the words, but the words are something I can use to help me, you know, as a support. So it was, anyway, that was something that sort of a different way of looking at the Dharma, you know, instead of something I have to learn, as something that supports the earth. Yeah, it's a mutual thing.
It seems like I've heard realization talked about with Kensho and Satori, where, as I understand it, Kensho is more like an impermanent, like you realize something and then it's gone, and Satori is more of a lasting, like full realization. And so I wonder if the Satori has an experiential quality.
The Denkoi. There's the Denko Roku, mm-hmm. like Keizan, and that's mm-hmm. all the masters up through Eijo's Satori, mm-hmm. right? Seems like it's often talked about as initiated with an experience.
I have a question that's just forming itself, and I'll still offer it. And it's it got stirred by something that you said yesterday, Doug, when you were commenting on, you know, the tea people waiting for you to give the signal, and you have been commenting throughout the session that whoever is doing whatever work at that moment is at the top of the hierarchy, and that thereby the hierarchy is fluid, right, mm-hmm. flexible. And that really touches me, that, you know, taking that in and digesting that. And so the question that's coming up is, for instance, when we're sitting in the sangha and we're having a discussion, and when I cling to that image of hierarchy, of thinking, you are the teacher, therefore I am the small student, am I making myself unnecessarily smaller? And is the teacher actually showing up in everybody? Can the teacher show up in the sangha? Can the teacher show up in everybody? Because essentially there is no hierarchy. And if we cling to that hierarchy, and I know, you know, there's form and we follow the form, but if in our mind we cling to that concept, we lessen ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're starting to compare and the idea of a flexible hierarchy or a fluid hierarchy, there are still distinctions made. And it's nice to when the rigidity of hierarchies can be dispelled. One Buddhist friend in Minnesota suggested to me that expectations are problematic, and that and I thought about expectations, and I thought, you know, yeah, to have no expectations is really beneficial. And I was soon to get married, and so we wrote our vows, and I included that in the vows, that you know, we live with no expectation. And I think it was after we were divorced, my former and I are still close because we got kids and grandkids, and there's still affinity. Our paths are in contrast. But for me, it saved me that no expectation, because we had young kids at home when we were having a young family, and I was going off to work. And back then I was working with shovels, wheelbarrows, sand, gravel, cement, making concrete, making grout, wheeling stuff, and just exhausted by the time I come home. And usually it's like, where's my dinner? It was what a tired guy would do. And I came home and I saw this mother with young kids who were intense and paying attention to every single one of them, you know, taking care of diaper, this, helping this, that, oh, I'm into trouble, pulling them out. And I was like, holy mackerel, you know, what level of intensity is that? I don't want anything to do with that right now. I'll go cook. So I'd cook for everybody regularly, not all the time, but she would cook too. But that whole holding to this idea of hierarchy, I'm the breadwinner here, I need food, it was just delightful to just drop it. And that vow helped me. Now I asked her if it helped her, and she said, all I wanted to do was marry you. It didn't matter what these vows were. So if it helps you, you know, it's fine. So it's like, you know, it means something to some of us and maybe not to anybody else. And I thought, okay, yeah, it worked.
She just showed up.
What did she?
I think Trungpa Rinpoche would call it a natural hierarchy. That's what he would call it, a natural hierarchy. That fluidity, situational. The situation has to give the authority.
Yeah.
Because it seems at times it is important for the teacher to teach, to help, to guide. Because if it's just a matter of whose opinion is better, the student just may continue to spin. But at the same time, if the teacher doesn't have the insight to step back, to reconsider what they've said, to reconsider how they're approaching it, then it's just obeisance. Mm-hmm. I know when Sokuzan gave me Dharma transmission, he did not say, you are now a great bodhisattva. He did not say, now you're a teacher. He said, you have now firmly established yourself as a student. Mm-hmm. And that was very important for me to hear. That it was actually consistently and continuously, even when I'm teaching, to be a student, to consider, to look. It's part of why the Dokusan was so precious to me, is that it was an opportunity for me to look at, what is this? What is this? not, yes, please come in, I would be happy to help you. So to firmly establish ourselves as a student is wonderful.
Yeah. And the student and the teacher have to meet, and the student may need the teacher, but the teacher definitely needs the student. So how does that work? And what is teaching? To transmit is to receive. And one of the, when I was given this, it's called a teaching stick. But when it was handed to me, I was pointed out how this curve is here. It's like an ear. This is actually a listening stick. And that was really helpful. John.
First of all, thank you for this whole idea of the host. I mean, that's a very powerful thing. I need to work on that one quite a bit, I think. In addition to that, though, can you connect, compare, contrast, whatever, suchness and emptiness? How do those two come together? Are they the same? I don't think they're quite the same, but I'm not sure I know what the difference is.
I think that's a wonderful question, and they're the same if you define them the same. They are concepts, but we talked just briefly about the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma the other day, and the second turning is shunyata, or emptiness, and it's not voidness, it's not nihilism.
Right.
A simple way of saying it is that things are empty of what you think about them. They're empty of your projections. Your projections are not arising from the table. It is something that something arises, we name it, we label it. The first three dharmas are the five dharmas of Lanka. But what is helpful to me is the third turning is the coming together of emptiness and luminosity. So in a sense, that recognition that it's neither this nor that, nor both, nor neither. That's like the tetralemma that comes up in the Lankavatara as well. So you could use them synonymously if your understanding of the two come together. But I think it's important is how is that term supportive to you in investigating, because the definition is only helpful so far as it encourages you to see it for yourself. And that's what I tend to come back with material like this, is instead of trying to get a foothold on it too strongly, is there a way that this can help me look more deeply? So for you, that's investigating this concept of shunyata and tatata. I think that's the Sanskrit for the thusness. Maybe it's just enough to hold those and say, what is that? Look at it. Isn't that Shoho's cat? Tattva, the thusness being? Is that what Tattva is?
I thought, I don't know. You don't know. I just, Tattva, I thought it was one of the Tibetan goddesses, maybe.
Oh, we should ask him. Yeah. The cat, that is.
The cat.
Since you got to pet it. Oh, look, did you hear that? Oh, people know that's an accomplishment. She was able to pet Papa.
Oh, good.
It was one little scratch, and then she bounced away.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Do you remember the first time you met Sessions?
I do. Do you?
No.
Sessions was 6'1". This is really good. This is really good. I left that story unresolved, remember, from day one, where I told everyone how much I didn't like Soka's.
Oh, okay.
And Doug asked me privately if I would please finish the story I stopped in the middle of. And Soka-san, I met him, and I emphasized how much difficulty I had with him, and I resisted him, and but I kept finding myself in front of him. And after I'd moved into the monastery, I still refused to have him as a teacher. I just didn't like it. And I was 23 and I was pestering him. I would ask really annoying questions, like kind of snotty. I was a bit snotty. And I was like, are you awake and are you enlightened? And like just bugging him. He was... So that's 23, he was 71. And he slammed his hand on a table and he this noise came out of him. It was a roar or a growl. And I immediately dissolved into tears. And he immediately started laughing. And it was to me my first experience with that there's something for me to see beyond all these petty thoughts of pride and arrogance and being a young person. And something shattered, and I became a student. I wanted the Dharma from him, and he was waiting for me very, very patiently.
Oh, was it being a good host?
Him?
This story.
Was he being a good host?
Yeah.
Beyond words, a type of compassion that will do anything to help. So I feel pretty grateful for that. Like I said, 6'1", 235 pound thusness. That
let me give one comes to mind for me. I was present when our first son was born. I was present for all of them. And to see, you know, it's one thing to eat and live and all this stuff. And it's fun to make babies. And it's fun to have these young ones too, but a lot of work. But I'll tell you, to see this being come out totally blew me away. It changed my reality completely. So that was a real, it was like, this is unbelievable, you know, what has just arrived. And yet, you know, we're all a result of that. And in that moment, you know, it's like, how can there ever be war? You know, how could there ever, you know, harmony is all that we can do with these young ones. So anyway, it was, that was one moment. There are probably others you know, where you bump your head on something, it's like, oh, now I see clearly. I need a duck. So they're recurring. Their experiences of deep realization, I'm going to repeat. I liked your example, Michael, of how adding just one more molecule and just coalesces.
We all lived in suchness until we developed words. The child just experiences it, just the world is just there until they start to develop. It's actually before words, but they start to separate from. But when the child is first born, the world is just there. Mom is me. Me, I'm mom. Everybody's me. It's just that. Unfortunately, we don't remember that, so we don't know what to do with it. But in fact, the newborn, that's the world they live in.
That reminds me, all this study of the Vatara, all these words, and for me in a second language, it was hard work, even though I really enjoyed it. And so yesterday, I remembered the story that is said it's the beginning of Zen when the Buddha picked the flower and showed it to the followers, and Mahakasyapa smiled. So in a way, I took refuge in that story. So there is the study and the words, and I like it, but I really like the sense beyond words.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said, that reminds me of that. And I think that's why I feel home in suchness, nothing to talk about.
The first question was, is suchness relative?
Yeah.
And what came to mind was the question, is suffering relative? You know, if I'm a father who loses a son in the Afghanistan conflict, versus a father who was a transgender child was born to them to face all of that. Are those are relative terms? The suffering is relative? Does that also apply to suchness?
Does it also apply to what?
To suchness. This was the first question from our good friend. Sorry, that's kind of a heavy question.
So could you rephrase that question, please?
So, the gentleman, first asked the question, is suchness relative? Is that right? Yeah. And what came up to me was, you know, is suffering relative? And suffering is part of that? Is suffering part of suchness?
Suffering is what arises with when we start making distinctions. Suffering, for example, we feel pain, and pain itself is a, we can do a lot of things with pain. You can, as a runner, you can run through the pain and get the endorphins going. You can accept the pain and see it for what it is and not be tormented by it. Or you can label the pain and make it horrible suffering. So it's what we do with these experiences that makes it suffering. I would call the experience of pain that is experiencing suchness. But then once the second thought arises, you're no longer in suchness. Kiritagiri Roshi talked about how we experience things and there's the first thought. When you get to the second thought, it's like you're already not in the moment anymore. You're not experiencing it as it is. You're already making distinctions of preferences or aversions or attachments. But when we see it as it is, that's suchness. And when, for example, Curtis sees a projection, as it is, as the film, and then it becomes, the projection loses its mirage, and the bigger reality and context appears. Curtis, there was, you also talked about haiku. And I remember you, I'd like to ask you to kind of repeat this notion of the haiku and the perceiving a perception. There was some description you gave that was real sweet. If you remember.
It's something like seeing the duality of things and maybe accepting that. And with the haiku, there's usually opposites. So you could say like there's the first two items are the opposites. The third thing is your presence or your awareness, applying the mind to receive those. And I guess the way I read haiku is I internalize those two polar ideas. Sort of dwell on the on the suchness of it, on the emptiness of it, because you can make really silly things that still kind of make sense, like driving up the hill, and like the second line could be like the birds are flying, and then you can like switch the words and say like flying up the hill, the birds are driving. Kind of the hard part is making a third line, but the essence of that is you present some two extreme opposites, reading that, you're sort of aware of it being completely making no sense at all, but it sort of makes sense in a way. So I think it's being aware of. That's the best I can come up with.
Thank you. trying to check in the team in the air. Or is it, do we want, is anyone in there have a question? Oh, did that?
That's not a hand.
Oh.
What is a hand?
Not a hand.
Thank you for your talk. It's been so helpful to get a sense for thusness and where that meets us. And what Tim's saying about being relative, I'm wondering about the meeting with someone in order to experience thusness. Because on my own, I'm wondering if it's real or not, or I'm wondering. This experience is like it doesn't, it's just my normal state. And then when I'm with you, I go, oh, we're both having thusness. Does that seem like something I would then know as opposed to by myself? That's just the state. I wake up in that state, I'm walking in, I don't know I'm in that state, so I meet you.
I think the animals around us are examples of that too. They don't have similar words. They do talk to each other, laugh with each other. What's amazing to me is how we conduct our lives and we check whether we're hydrated, we check whether we're hungry, and then or we check with what we want, our desire, and then we can go get it and go get and go get, open the refrigerator and go drive ourselves to the store. We can imagine things on the internet, and we have bank accounts that sustain us over a long period of time. And yet around us are all these beings that they have a day's supply of food that they go and eat. Maybe it's several days is laying on the ground or but basically, there's no refrigerator for them. There's no compost heap. There's no trash can. There's, I guess they do have rubble piles of open acorns, the squirrels do. But, and they're in a state of, they're not yelling of agony. Very often, they're in a state of they're meeting it. Time for food, they find it. And I've used this example before. There are seven factors of awakening that are described, and four of them. Well, this is what I remember, paying attention or mindfulness is one of the factors of awakening. Discerning what is in front of you is a second factor of awakening. Putting forth effort is another factor. Concentration is a factor of awakening. And then there's more subtle ones of two others that I remember are tranquility is one of them, and a sense of peace, where things come together. And in observing the turkeys when they are traveling through here in the spring, and the young turkeys are following, there's a lead mother turkey, and then all the young ones, and then two moms in the rear. And they are, the one in the front is looking, paying attention, where they're going, discerning where to go. They're concentrating, because they're concentrating not only on what they need, but what their group needs. And they parade through, and the two in the rear are checking the rear guard. But they're exhibiting paying attention. They're exhibiting concentration. They're exhibiting effort. They're exhibiting one of the other ones.
Discernment.
Yeah, discernment. So these turkeys have exhibit in from observing them four of the seven factors of awakening. That's just turkeys. Now, how about their sense of peacefulness and tranquility? It's hard to measure those, but maybe they have those too. So we pride ourselves as humans of being what we are, I guess. But I just want to point out that in the realm of living organisms, there's all these other kinds of consciousness that exist, and we are like them, and they are like us. So it's like, how refined do we get in making distinctions in our path when really in nature, all of this, a lot of this is already in existence, and we are part of that. So it just gives me some solace of, you know, when we're competing in high school for getting the best grades, and it's like, how am I going to get into the best college, or is he going to get into the best college, or, you know, where, how's this going to all work out? And when you realize that organisms are thriving with these factors of awakening already, and we're able to discern, describe it in so many exotic ways, sometimes meaningful ways, I don't know, it just helps me that it's special what we're doing, but it isn't that extraordinary. Maybe it might be pretty common and among living organisms. So does a turkey have Buddha nature? Does a turkey experience suchness?
It seems so. And yeah. Likewise, it seems we're, you know, maybe we don't recognize it because we're just in it. But when we have a meeting with someone who is also in suchness, like a teacher, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a special thing in a sense, because it's like we're both seeing it together. And that awakening or that realization is met with the whole people seeing it. It's just amazing. It doesn't happen like on my own. Like I don't wake up in the morning and have that amazing, I mean, I do feel amazing, but I don't feel like it's that same thing. Like when I'm with my teacher, or when I'm with that mutual recognition of essence. So I think that's a really interesting thing that I cling to. You know, like it's the point, the watch, you know, that clinging thing. Because it's here all the time, potentially. It's normal, natural. Yet, the moment I recognize it fully,
So I think like it's something special. Yeah, I'm not sure this is helping at all, but I just feel it's just what you're saying, Doug, is it's kind of lost all around us. Yet we're missing.
Yeah. Annette brought up just, you know, you were talking about meeting the teacher and going, both of them going, aha, you know, with that flower and the Buddha and mosque and Kajiyaba. And that's why this practice requires touching, doesn't it? Contact. It's
warm hand to warm hand. That's how we talk about warm hand to warm hand.
Yeah. Anton?
I was wondering, like, how is it for people around here? Like, when you went to the mountain this morning, to the ridge, the sunrise, for me, it was close. And just experiencing it, like, the immediacy of, you know, this is happening in this moment.
I wrote a haiku about it. It doesn't follow the, it just, I'll just say it. Shakuhachi wind dances with the morning rays high above the clouds. I'll say it again. Shakuhachi wind dances with the morning rays high above the clouds. That's what it was like for me.
If anyone would like to do some yoga in here, please get with Nora. And by 5:25, we should have the room back together for the evening sit.
We need to collect all of the teacups.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.